This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 18th of June 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Tyler Brûlé, and Dominic Reynolds.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we go to Athens where it's crunch time for the Greek government over their state broadcaster ERT.
And journalist and author Rachel Shabi will join us to talk Israel, Syria, and a golf resort in Northern Ireland. She's setting today's agenda.
We'll also hear from a heavyweight of British public life with a bit of advice on how to revamp the capitalist system.
I think you can hold to the fundamental beliefs of capitalism, a belief in markets, that individuals hold productive assets and that markets are how you guide production and distribute wealth.
Then we're in Madrid to discover how designers are attempting to power industry there.
This is a project which is radically different to what I have done before, because before I have always worked with industry. This time the aim was to work with artisans and bonded to one of the most industrial products on Earth, which is a plastic bottle.
Not only that, we'll play some music too. That is all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
And good morning from Studio One here at Midori House in London. Dominic Wells, nice to see you. It's been a very long time.
I haven't seen
the back of your head up on the editorial floor.
I know. Well, now, where have I been?
Not a glimpse or a whiff.
I'm beginning to think you're avoiding me.
No, I'm not avoiding you at all.
I just come in early. I start the day, you see.
You know, I think I'm probably just sort of, you know, maybe flipping on the lights for you a couple of hours because I'm doing the late shift. I was thinking, though, the weather is absolutely stunning today. I was talking to some of our sound engineers. I think we should actually take the show out up onto the terrace. I think Midori House would be very nice. We could wave to the people commuting through Paddington Garden on their way to work.
This is it. The people who are like, I'm not sure what goes on in that building. Well, few people who don't know.
Do you ever look at that? I sort of think people sort of sit there in the morning. There's sort of huddled groups. They see sort of TVs on and there's a bit of life in there. But the building, of course, looks a little bit like a school. But I was thinking it would be rather smart. We've got all the furniture out there. There's enough of a buffer. There's enough sort of, you know, fluffy foliage as well.
So people can
get a total idea.
We can have a little bit of privacy.
Yeah, I'm thinking it involves maybe a Black & Decker drill because the space would just be right above the studio here, because in fact this is the terrace above our heads.
Annoyingly, I forgot my drill today, Tyler. I'm sorry.
Did you?
Yeah, I always bring it in every day. I'm like, in case Tyler needs the Black & Decker, I'll bring it.
Right, well, we can probably sort that out, which is very good. We should also probably get on with the news of the
Let's
day right
do it.
Now. Bill Bingham is here.
Monocle 24 News. Afghan forces have formally taken over security for the whole of Afghanistan from NATO-led troops. President Hamid Karzai announced the move, which completes a process begun in 2011, at a ceremony where NATO forces handed over control of the last 95 districts. The event marks a significant milestone since US-led forces ousted the Taliban following the 9/11 attacks of 2001. Just before today's ceremony, a large bomb exploded in Kabul, killing 3 people and wounding 6. The death toll from flooding and landslides triggered by heavy rain in northern India has passed 60. India's media say at least 40 people have died in Uttarakhand state, with deaths reported in Himachal Pradesh and Uttar Pradesh. The river Ganges and its tributaries are flowing above the danger mark in several areas. The G8 summit continues today in Northern Ireland, with tax, trade and transparency expected to dominate discussions. The 3 T's, as they're called, have been placed at the top of the agenda by the United Kingdom for its presidency of the G8. Although world leaders are meant to be discussing how to revive the global economy, their different views on Syria's civil war overshadow other topics. Russia has warned it will not allow the imposition of a no-fly zone over Syria. Security in Northern Ireland's capital, Belfast, was high for US President Barack Obama's first visit to the country on his way to the summit beside Lough Erne in County Fermanagh. These Belfast residents say it was effective.
I don't think anyone will get away with anything. I've just been sitting on a train for an hour trying to get into Belfast. It's pretty extreme.
The security is excellent. It's not oppressive at all. And it's great to see that the protesters or the idiots have all stayed away.
Not as much as we anticipated, to be honest with you, which is good. I think it's been controlled. But again, it's kind of a free society, so they're able to protest and welcome to protest if they need to be.
Israel is warning the world not to ease the pressure on Iran's nuclear program. The country's new president, Hassan Rouhani, has promised greater transparency, but he's also warned Tehran won't give up its uranium enrichment work. Benjamin Netanyahu says it'd be a mistake to trust new promises from Iran.
They've unchanged, they've not been wavering in their goal to achieve enough fissile material to make a nuclear bomb. They should be stopped. They should not be allowed to pursue this.
More than 100,000 people have been marching through cities across Brazil in protest over rising public transport prices and the cost of staging the 2014 Football World Cup. Tens of thousands of people marched through Brazil's largest city, São Paulo. Marches took place in at least 10 other cities, including the capital, Brasilia, where demonstrators climbed onto the roof of the National Congress building. Protesters also clashed with police near Rio de Janeiro's State Assembly. A Greek court has ordered that the state broadcaster ERT, which was shut down by the government last week, can start broadcasting again. But the court also upheld a plan by Prime Minister Antonis Samaras to replace ERT with a smaller broadcaster. ERT will remain on air until the new broadcaster with the government, which the government says will be called NERIT, will be launched. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Bill, thank you very much. It is 10.06 in Tel Aviv, 8.06 a.m. here in London. You're listening to Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
And as you were just hearing in the bulletin a few minutes ago, the green light is back on in studios across Athens, and the airwaves are set to crackle back to life. Greek state broadcaster ERT has been told it can now resume transmission. It's after the Greek court stepped into the row over the national broadcaster following its overnight closure last week. But the court has also upheld a plan for ERT to ultimately be replaced by a smaller, leaner broadcaster.
Now, the row has triggered major protests across Greece, of course. The government claims that ERT suffered from chronic mismanagement, wastefulness, and a lack of transparency. But ERT's union has argued politicians shouldn't be able to turn screens black. So after that short break, then, what's coming up next for the broadcaster? And how bad is the damage to the government?
Constantine Buhair is author of Greece, Culture Smart. He joins us here in the studio. And also our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, is going to be joining us on the line from Athens in a moment as well. Constantine, good morning.
Good morning.
Tell us, what did the situation look like if we would rewind 2 or 3 years ago and if we'd wandered the halls and studios of ERT? Was it this, you know, fat beast of a public broadcaster which was overstaffed and not that productive, or is the government over-egging it a bit?
Yes, I think you've put your finger on it. I'll give you one example. In 2004, we had general elections in Greece. The opposition goes into government, which is the New Democracy, and PASOK, which was the former government, is out of government. So you would expect, when you turn on the national television, to hear about the new government. In fact, the people in the national television had been placed by the former government, and the news they gave was about the opposition, the outgoing government. You had just about nothing about the new government. So what happens after that? The new government of New Democracy gradually replaces the personnel with its own people who start broadcasting its own message. However, it does not dismiss the former personnel placed by the previous government. So you have an accumulation of personnel and a lot of people doing absolutely nothing, which built up to about 2,700 personnel, most of them doing nothing.
And it is, we hear, going to be a lot leaner. All of those 2,700 people have lost their jobs at this point. I wonder, given that it's a Canadian and a Brit hosting today, we're used to the BBC and the CBC as national broadcasters. They stand for all sorts of things. They also stand for unimpeachable journalistic standards, or at least they should, and they would claim they do. is the same thing the case with ERT? And so is journalism going to be taking a hit from this?
Indeed. Overall, it is an objective and highly valuable station. Therefore, losing this would be absolutely tragic, just as if it would be losing PBS in America or Canada or Britain. Supreme Council of State said is that a new caretaker has to take over. It can keep the old personnel, bring in new personnel, or it can fire the old personnel. However, under Article 15, I believe, of the Greek Constitution, there has to be a broadcasting state agency.
Mm. I want to come back to you in a moment and just maybe we can speculate on what the future shape and size of this new broadcaster might be like. But in the meantime, our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, is on the line in Athens. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Tyler. Good morning, John.
Tell us, how much of this is this a discussion point at the moment? I know your legs haven't been on the ground too long there.
It is, and I think what's interesting about it is that it kind of helps to sum up some of the major problems that Greece is facing at the moment. This was a decision by the Prime Minister Samaras, made without support, without even the knowledge of his coalition partners. And so that's underlined the problem that he has in ruling as part of that coalition. I mean, I think it's also highlighted some issues that the Greek government has with the so-called Troika, the IMF, the European Central Bank, and the European Union. And because Samaras can say, look, I've tried to implement some of these reforms you want me to do, and look what happens when I try to do it. There are major protests. So those two issues, I think, are the sort of the broader talking points here in Athens.
I wonder, Konstantin, if we can come back to you briefly. To use the parallel of either PBS or the BBC or CBC, indeed, there are a lot of cultural institutions attached to these public broadcasters. There are orchestras, there are people sort of working in the cultural life. So potentially, is there damage to be done to the Greek cultural life because of this broadcaster's problems?
Yes, the orchestras, there's the symphonic orchestra and smaller orchestras, they're off the map. The new caretaker will not be including these people in the new format. There's no doubt about that.
Just tell us, what will happen, though, to maybe some of the famous faces and voices, and just going back to John's journalism question as well, do you think we'll see a carryover of the voice of God who delivers the news every night or every morning? Will there be a direct transfer? Because obviously, these types of assets as personalities, are usually pretty good for viewer or listenership numbers.
ERT had just about the lowest viewing rates in Greece, despite its valuable role. It was about 3%. Therefore, I'm not sure they will necessarily be missed, though valuable they are, of course.
I was actually thinking that when you sort of talk about the partisan setup of the joint, I think maybe there must be a whole program to be done on sort of lunch in the cafeteria, what that must be like.
That sounds like great fun. I think commissioning editors' ears are pricking up somewhere as we speak. Konstantin, what about the shape, the size, what this new institution will be? We've got a name, we think. Do we know how that's going to be divided up and what sort of difference consumers of that content might see?
The new face will probably emerge in September, as long as we don't have elections up till then. The number of personnel they will keep is from 2,700 to about 700 or so, it is rumoured. There will be key personnel kept, there will be old cronies who will be kept, and I think the ERT will continue to provide a good and valuable service, as it has always done, though a much leaner one, no doubt.
Mm, and perhaps just a last word to Athens. Steve, the mood, summer is shifting into high gear, summer solstice almost upon us. Give us the feeling on the street in Athens.
Well, there was a strange sense of relief last night that this deal had been done and then that the court case had come through, because the other option was fresh elections. And the one thing that pretty much everyone in Greece can agree on is that no one wants fresh elections. So the fact that that has been avoided is certainly good. Over the next two or three days, I'm going to be out and about in Athens reporting for Monocle 24 and also for the Aero Mediterraneo, our summer newspaper. And when I'm back, I'm sure I'll be able to give you a bit more in terms of how things are feeling here on the ground.
Steve, we look forward to catching up with you then. Steve is, of course, our foreign editor. Thank you to Konstantin Buheya here in the studio. You are listening to Monocle 24. Our agenda setter is next.
Section D is the show you listen to for the untold stories, secrets and blazing headlines in the design sphere. The architects, fashion followers, artists and engineers who are making and breaking the trends across the world.
When Valentino touches the clothes, you see his hands tracing those lines of shape, form, and to see Valentino arranging one of his dresses is to understand the dress in terms of structure.
Join me, Hugo MacDonald, for an hour of insight, interviews and discussion every Tuesday at 1900 hours London time.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24. The Globalist Asia is our brand new show covering global stories, but with a focus on what's shaping the business day from Beijing to Bangkok, Singapore to Sydney.
My vision of the Japan, how I see with this, I mean, I grew up in Paris, but that's how I see Japan.
There are also fresh insights from our global network of correspondents, contributors and editors, including a survey of the Asian front pages.
We're going to disagree to disagree, and we're just going to keep doing it and doing it and doing it, and no one really has a playbook for how this turns out at all.
So tune in to The Globalist Asia every weekday for your global news digest. That's The Globalist Asia at 3 a.m. in Hong Kong, 4 a.m. in Tokyo, and 6 a.m. in Sydney. Brought to you in association with GE.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House. You're in Studio One with me, Tyler Brulé and Dominic Reynolds. Dom, just before we go on to our next segment, Steve Bloomfield promised us that he would be out and about on the streets of Athens for the next 3 days. Sounded like he'd already done 3 days. I know there is a time change, but it sounds like we sort of caught him at 4 a.m.
You think he wasn't perky enough?
I thought the content was great. He just wasn't his normal sparky self.
Yeah, it's unusual. Perhaps, he must have been tramping up and down those streets. He's got knackered thighs.
Well, I'm absolutely thrilled that, of course, then the mood is buoyant enough in Greece to keep him going of an evening.
Yes, indeed. Well, we are going to move on to our agenda setter as we do at this point in the programme. And joining us in the studio is journalist and author Rachel Shabby. Rachel, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Excellent. Nice to be back on.
Great. Well, nice to have you with us as ever. And you have picked the three stories that you think are going to be driving news agendas today. Which is the first?
Well, the first one is, of course, the G8 summit that's taking place at the moment. And most of the newspapers this morning focusing on this very sort of icy atmosphere, shall we say. Let's call it an atmosphere between Russian President Putin and the US President Obama. Obviously, a massive disagreement over Syria, which is really controlling the G8 agenda this time round. To the extent, Russia obviously doesn't agree with the rest of the G8 countries, to the extent that the Canadian Prime Minister has now dubbed it G7 plus one, i.e., you know, a gang of nations wanting to arm the Syrian rebels and increase the arms flow to the rebels, and Russia saying, no, that's not the way to do things, and sort of resisting any kind of agreement on Syria within the G8.
It's interesting that Mr. Harper's point, and I think that maybe, you know, he was the one who had to sort of come out in front and say it, that I think, you know, many have been thinking for a while it should just go back to the cozy group of G7. Are you surprised? I mean, listen, I mean, this is, you talk about elephants or, you know, enormous landmasses in the sitting room. It really had to come to this, do you think?
It's not surprising, but at the same time, you know, it's a little bit unfair to call it the G7 plus one, in the sense that, I mean, you look at Britain, it's not exactly a united front of agreement to arm the Syrian rebels. You know, the Lib Dem leader Nick Clegg opposes it. Cameron faces a lot of opposition to that within his own cabinet, never mind within his own party. So it's a little bit mean of the Canadian Prime Minister to say that. But as you say, it's no surprise is that Syria would top the agenda at the G8, and it's no surprise that it would come to this. But it is worth noting that the Russian position isn't, oh, let's just arm Assad. Its position has always been, well, we need to negotiate. You can't arm for peace. You know, the only way out of this is to get everybody to the negotiating table.
Rachel, we're going to come back to the cloudy Northern Irish skies of the G8 in a moment, but let's head to Israel next. And more sort of quite punchy rhetoric coming out over the issue of the two-state solution.
Yeah, to the sunny skies of Israel. Where...
I didn't want to speculate about the weather, that's the thing. I couldn't bring up the weather in Tel Aviv fast enough, sorry.
Yeah, well, that would have been really easy. It would have been as easy as the Canadian Prime Minister's dig at Russia, in
well,
fact.
Well, indeed, yeah.
But, and as lame. But
thanks. OK, back on topic now.
Back
come on
topic. Yes, we have another Israeli government official saying, you know what, two-state solution, waste of time. It's a complete dead end. Let's stop talking about it. Let's stop pretending. Let's just call it what it is, which is Greater Israel. The land has always been ours and it's never been Palestinian, et cetera, et cetera. So that's just one more very high-profile Israeli government minister that has been saying what a lot of Israeli government ministers have been saying over the last 2 years. Timing is unfortunate given that the US Secretary of State, John Kerry, is really trying to revive the two-state solution. So at the very same time that he's shuttling into the region to try and revive this process, you have an Israeli government official saying, no point, it's a dead end.
Well, oftentimes when you look from an urban perspective, you know, anytime a city suddenly tries to bring in the suburbs and call anything greater anything, it usually sort of, you know, ends up as a complete catastrophe. I say this as a Torontonian, where it hasn't worked very well with our Mayor Robert. But that aside...
bitterness to your question.
No, it's
and
bit,
I don't mean to, and I don't mean to bring it back
now.
To... I don't mean to bring it back to Canada, Rachel. But this idea of and we know it's all shorthand. But do you think that is an option? And how much of a talking point do you think we get out of this?
I mean, I think for some time people on the ground have been saying, look, it's one state with two separate systems of control and rights. Palestinians have less rights and obviously less control. It doesn't take much time to be in that area, and I was based there for 5 years. It doesn't take a long time to see that effectively it is one state on the ground. So for a right-wing Israeli minister to say that, I mean, the Palestinian response to this is very much, oh, well, the only difference is that he's saying it out loud as opposed to just thinking it and, you know, putting on a different face to the international community.
Well, I wonder, he is saying it out loud. And we had, is it Danny Danon a week or so ago, who's from Netanyahu's own party, saying something fairly similar? I wonder how much longer do various little sources of this sort of line need to be coming up before Netanyahu really needs, you know, he's distanced himself from everybody who has said this. At what point does his rhetoric end up needing to change to some degree?
Well, he's distanced himself only in the sense that he has the sense not to say these things out loud, but effectively his policy is pretty much the same thing. It was very interesting. There was a State Department journalism conference last week. The State Department has these weekly journo briefings. And at that time, there was the State Department official had to really field a lot of very hostile questions from the US press corps saying, hang on a minute, you say that you oppose Israeli settlement policy, which is seen as the number one obstacle to reviving of the negotiations. But there is no penalty from you if Israel says no. So what's the point? You know, it's basically you're just saying no, but
yeah, stop.
Kind of yes.
It's like stop or I'll shoot, or stop or I'll say no again.
Stop and then, or I'll get really angry with you.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Wait, we're going to have to leave it there. We're going to talk tax evasion, but a point to, I think, evade because we have to go to our next segment. We're heading off to Madrid. Thanks very much for that.
Thank you.
You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Back in a moment.
The time is 15:24 in Shanghai, 9:24 in Madrid, 8:24 a.m. here in London. We shift to Spain now for a preview of Monocle's design programme, which you know is called Section D.
Yes, indeed. In Madrid City Hall, a new exhibition, Fuera de Serie, is showcasing some of the practical virtues of design. The collection is intended to trumpet all the requisite design buzzwords of late: smart, dynamic, sustainable. But at a time when Spain's unemployment crisis is biting hard, curator Ana Dominguez wanted to show Spaniards that good design can be a motor for industry too.
Indeed, the exhibition includes a plethora of international talent, but she's placed a deliberate focus on local Spanish designers. Our correspondent Liam Aldous set out to talk to those involved.
I had to think of something that could be read at a very basic level for everyone. It came with this idea of showing projects that where design is important in the way that can change things that already exist and give it a different meaning.
I'm talking to design journalist and curator Ana Dominguez, whose latest exhibition, Fuera de Serie, is as much a celebration of design as it is a didactic display of its potential.
We're having this horrible recession, so it's all also a way of showing people ideas or how can they use what they have in a different way to survive this crisis. Many people think that this exhibition is about craftsmanship, which is many of the projects, it's true that many of the projects are craft-based, but it's not only that. It's also I'm showing some industrial process that have been changed or, you know, that had a witty way of looking at them by the designer. In this case, for example, there is a table by Jaime Ayón, which is for a company called C in London. And what Jaime did is a metallic table that would have been very expensive to do if they didn't find the molds with which the front of planes are made. So they found this little factory in France. They found a cemetery of molds that are not used anymore, and they used one of these molds to make this table. So it's an ingenious way of using the process, and it's industrial.
This is a common concern in Spain's design community. The gradual erosion of industry has left many designers without a leg to stand on. So, while there may be a surplus of talent and creativity, a dwindling manufacturing sector means that much of it doesn't get far from the designer floor.
If you look at the shapes, they are amazing because they come from old lamps. So we cut them in different places, no? So you really see in some vases and some glasses where the oil lamp was, but as it was a functional object, the shapes are very simple, and that was very good for doing the designs.
Paloma Cañizares from PCM Design believes that artists and industry should collaborate more. She's also the driving force behind a unique project that has seen Slovakian glassware extraordinaire Thomas Kral collaborate with the Spanish royal glassware manufacturer La Real Granja de San Ildefonso.
The problem is that La Granja closed from 1890 to 1980, so almost 100-year close, so they didn't develop anything in the 20th century. So really, this was the first contemporary project they made. Well, it was in the 21st century, but it was quite interesting for them to work on something new, because really what they are focused on is on reproductions of the crystalware from 19th and 18th century. So really this was like a lot of fresh air for them. The collaboration started because I was working with Thomas Kral on some projects, and he has a long tradition from where he's from. He's from Slovakia with crystal. So I wanted to do a crystal project, but with Spanish crystal. So I went to La Granja de San Ildefonso, which is the most renowned. We asked them if they wanted to do a project.
Known as the Reused History Project, Thomas Kral's glassware designs were a bestseller, throwing a much-needed lifeline to the ailing La Granja. But while Paloma may be helping to unite talents, she believes that the economic crisis isn't the only reason some of Spain's centuries-old craftsmanship is locked in a state of atrophy.
Their main problem is that they don't know how to update and how to focus on giving solutions to the new needs of the people. Now they still think the clients would be the same classic clients from always, but the truth is that the clients are changing their tastes and they don't really want the same objects from 19th and 18th century.
Another ubiquitous object from the 21st century that people just don't seem to want is the plastic bottle. However, designer Álvaro Catalán de Ocón has brought new meaning to the old adage, one person's trash is another person's treasure.
This is a project which is radically different to what I have done before, because before I have always worked with industry. This time the aim was to work with artisans and bond it to one of the most industrial products on earth, which is the plastic bottle, the PET bottle.
Working with indigenous artisans from the Amazon in Colombia, Álvaro's design for slicing up discarded plastic bottles allowed the local artisans to weave in their own unique textile patterns to create a colourful array of lampshades.
We first called four artisans. Next day came seven, because the grandfather and the nephew and the brother and the sister, and then the next day they were 15, and now we have like 30 of them working on the project, no? And you see that it grows and grows and grows, and that's in a way what we want, no? We want it to spread, and it has proved super success. We have been really shocked by the response. Well, I think it's been also very successful in a way that we tried to not take the European style to a tropical country, but bring the tropical country style into Europe, no? And with this crisis and with this dullness, no, and everything seems to be grey, and we brought up these colourful tropical patterns and shapes, and it's like a party, no? And it's full of colours and the cables and the lamps and floating in the air, and people like felt it was a very fresh idea.
Álvaro's transatlantic project is a vivid example of what can happen when various sectors work together to achieve a common goal. Collaboration that most Spanish designers would surely agree is the key to their survival.
It was nearly like an impossible project with 1,000 pieces. It was like an enormous puzzle, which each piece needed to fit its place in order to work. And it magically fitted.
For Monocle in Madrid, I'm Lee Moldus.
Liam, thank you very much for that. And for more reports on design from around the globe, you can tune in, of course, to Section D tonight at 1900 hours London time. In the next half hour of the programme, we're going to be speaking with our man in Seoul for the latest there, including the latest diplomatic shenanigans from the north. We'll also have a run through of the Canadian papers, and we will speak to a heavyweight of British public life, no less.
And now we have a heavyweight of world news. Bill Bingham is here with the bottom of our headlines.
Afghan forces have formally taken over security for the whole of Afghanistan from NATO-led troops. President Hamid Karzai announced the move, which completes a process begun in 2011, at a ceremony where NATO forces handed over control for the last 95 districts. Just before the ceremony, a large bomb exploded in Kabul, the capital, killing three people and wounding six. The death toll from flooding and landslides triggered by heavy rain in northern India has passed 60. India's media say at least 40 people have died in Uttarakhand state, with deaths reported in Himachal Pradesh and Uttar Pradesh. The river Ganges and its tributaries are flowing above the danger mark in several areas. The G8 summit continues today in Northern Ireland, with tax, trade and transparency expected to dominate discussions. The three T's, as they're called, have been placed at the top of the agenda by the United Kingdom for its presidency of the G8. Although world leaders are meant to be discussing how to revive the global economy, their different views on the Syrian civil war overshadow other topics. Israel is warning the world not to ease the pressure on Iran's nuclear program. The country's new president, Hassan Rouhani, has promised greater transparency, but he's also warned Tehran won't give up its uranium enrichment work. More than 100,000 people have been marching through cities across Brazil in protest over rising public transport prices and the cost of staging the 2014 Football World Cup. Tens of thousands of people marched through Brazil's largest city, São Paulo. Marches took place in at least 10 other cities, including the capital, Brasilia, where demonstrators climbed onto the roof of the National Congress building. A Greek court has ordered that the state broadcaster ERT, which was shut down by the government last week, can start broadcasting again. But the court also upheld a plan by Prime Minister Antonis Samaras to replace ERT with a smaller broadcaster. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Bill, thank you. We'll see you in a little under half an hour. Now, Baron Sainsbury of Turville, or David Sainsbury to his mates, has had an illustrious career. He's chairman of the British supermarket heavyweight that bears his name. He's a life peer in the UK's House of Lords. He's a philanthropist, and for those spare hours in between, he's current Chancellor of the University of Cambridge.
You try living up to that, Dom.
I know. I do two shows a day, so come on.
Most recently, David has written a proposal to transform the existing capitalist system. This is not the first time we've had an author on Midori House who's found neoliberalism to be waning. His tome is called Progressive Capitalism. He recently joined our Steve Bloomfield, who's getting a lot of airtime this morning, to discuss how government can better uphold the public interest.
David Sainsbury, thank you very much for joining us today. You've written a book called Progressive Capitalism. Is that an oxymoron?
I chose it because many people will think it's an oxymoron. I don't think it is. I think you can hold to the fundamental beliefs of capitalism, a belief in markets, that individuals hold productive assets and that markets are how you guide production and distribute wealth, and still believe that the state is important, that the state has to design institutions, and that social justice is an important measure of performance.
Now, that's all well and good, but 5 years ago people said, well, this is a moment for the centre-left because we've had this global economic crisis and the answers are only to be found in progressive capitalism, in the new centre-left, and it hasn't really worked out like that, has it?
Well, I think the very interesting thing is I thought that when we had the financial crash of 2008, people would immediately see that the doctrine of neoliberalism had serious flaws and would reject it and start looking for another political economy. Of course, most people don't actually follow those things in those terms, and not in the immediate sense. I don't think it affected a lot of people's lives. 4 years later, after a stream of stories of what bankers did in this thing and people seeing how it affects their lives, I think people now are just beginning to get very angry about this and start thinking what went wrong in the system.
Part of the problem that you and your party here in this country, the Labour Party, have, though, is that, rightly or wrongly, and if you look properly at the economics, perhaps wrongly, people think that the reason why we're in such dire straits now is because the government that you were in spent too much money.
I think one of the things the Conservatives have been very successful in doing is getting that story as being the story. Of course, it isn't what happened. We were the government when there was a credit boom or bubble, and that burst as bubbles always do. And undoubtedly also, we should have used the good times to reduce the deficit. But what caused the financial crash, or made it much, much worse, was what happened with the banks, on which they became highly leveraged, took on far too much debt, and then effectively went bankrupt in the crash of 2008. And that's what made the whole bubble so destructive. As I say, we should have spotted it, but no one did, and certainly the Conservative Party didn't. And we should have used the good times to get the deficit down, which would have made it easier in this period to keep public expenditure higher. But that doesn't tell you that there wasn't an appalling failure of the system.
Let's talk about the Labour Party and where it is right now. A series of quite short questions and bigger question at the end. You've donated a lot of money in the past to the Labour Party before, yes?
Yes, a considerable amount.
You want the Labour Party to win at the next election, yes?
I have to say at this particular moment, I don't feel this is a kind of life and death issue as I have in the past. I mean, in the past, as in, for instance, 1997, I thought that it was absolutely vital that the Labour Party was elected because the Conservative Party was in a terrible state, had really given up, and one needed a new government, and a Labour government was what was required. At the moment, I have to say, I don't think the Conservatives are doing it very well, but I don't think the Labour Party at this point can say, well, we would absolutely clearly make this better.
OK, I was expecting a one-word yes answer to that, which was then going to lead me on to the question, why aren't you donating money to the Labour Party now? But I think you've kind of answered that. What is going wrong then with the Labour Party, which makes ordinary people think, I'm not going to vote for them, and someone like yourself say, I'm going to keep my money in my pocket?
Well, I think they're suffering from what the Conservative Party is also suffering from, which is they don't have leaders who have a very clear vision of what kind of society they want and how they want to run things. And I think that's true of all three political parties at the moment. you don't have a sense with any of them that there is a real core of belief and a clear vision for what they want the country to do. But I should say also, I'm not that keen to get involved in large party funding at this moment because I have two roles. One is Chancellor of Cambridge University and the other is running as chairman of the Institute of Government. And both these roles, I think, are better done if you're outside. You know, you're not in the heart of politics and therefore can talk to all political parties.
One of your other previous roles when you were in the Labour government was as the Minister for Science and Innovation. I wanted to ask you particularly about innovation. When you look at the challenges that Britain as a country faces, are you surprised or disappointed that we don't seem to have as much innovation here as perhaps there was 100 or 200 years ago? Is that a fair analysis?
I don't think so, necessarily. I mean, the story has always been we're fantastically good at the science and we remain extraordinarily good at the science, but we're not very good at turning that into innovation. In the Labour government, we did tackle this issue and we brought in various things like the Higher Education Innovation Fund, which actually I think has transformed that situation in terms of universities having spin-off companies, working with companies and so on. And at about the time I left government, I had a study done comparing our universities against American universities, and they're pretty much the same standard now in terms of knowledge transfer. So I think the old story of good at science, bad at innovation is no longer true. We remain extraordinarily good at the science, and we're now quite a leading country in terms of knowledge transfer.
And do you feel that that transfers itself into the general economy? Do you feel that innovation is actually helping to boost our economy as much as our economy is being boosted
at the moment? I mean, just look at something like the Cambridge cluster, which is now, across the world, is well known as one of the great high-tech clusters and has got a large number of spin-off companies, these companies growing. And I think that has a huge impact now on our economy. But it's not only Cambridge. I mean, Oxford has it, Bristol has important cluster, York, Surrey, Southampton. I mean, there are now some really serious clusters of high-tech businesses around our world-class research universities.
And that was our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, talking to David Sainsbury. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
It's that time of year when Monocle's mighty July-August double issue hits the newsstands with a glorious and satisfying thud. It's the issue where we name the best cities to call home, meet the people who know how to run a good metropolis, check out the businesses that care about more than profits, and also find a few dustier, grittier places that you should know. Here's what our editors have lined up for you to enjoy on your lounger.
In the design section, we go street cleaning with the wonderful Greenbird team in Tokyo. We knock on the doors of the people who live in the pioneering Harlan estate outside Bern, and we strip off for a steamy fashion story in Helsinki's newest, cutest public sauna.
In the edit section, we take you for a stroll around some of the world's best public parks, including Singapore Gardens by the Bay, Margaret Island in Budapest, and São Paulo's Ibirapuera Park, three places where you can work out surrounded by nature, sculptures, and open-air cinema.
The July-August issue of Monocle also includes our inaugural 68-page food and entertaining guide and a 24-page Rio de Janeiro survey. It will keep you content with content all summer long. It's on newsstands now, or get yourself a subscription. Visit monocle.com to find out how.
So this is Midori House on Monocle 24. Today with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Tyler Brulé. It's 16:43 in Seoul, 10:43 in Ankara, 8:43 here in sunny London.
Yeah, it's cocktail hour almost in Seoul, which means it's perfect time to check in with our Jason Strother there. Hello, Jason.
Hello. Too bad I'm a teetotaler. Otherwise, I'd be enjoying that cocktail, Tyler. Yeah, one of the only ones here in Korea.
Yeah, I was going to say, we could spend a lot of time on that, but we'll do that another day. Should we head north of the border, maybe, and talk all things North Korean and, of course, potentially olive branches or at least something resembling dialogue with the U.S.?
Right, yeah, North Korea is making some overtures now to Washington. Of course, it was just a week ago that proposed talks between Pyongyang and Seoul fell apart with less than 24 hours to go. But Washington appears to be reacting quite coolly to the North's suggestion to hold talks without any preconditions at Washington's own time and location. Pretty much, D.C. is saying that nothing has changed, North Korea needs to show that it's sincere first before it's going to engage in any dialogue with the regime.
It seems that a few months ago we had this sort of frenzy of rhetoric firing out of North Korea, and now it's turned into a sort of frenzy of diplomacy. Talks with everybody all of the time. What is the tone change here?
Absolutely, Dom. Well, I mean, and not only is the North reaching out to Seoul and Washington, it's sending one of its top envoys to Beijing later this week, tomorrow actually, to hold talks there. Meanwhile, South Korean, Japanese, and American diplomats are going to be meeting in Washington on Wednesday to discuss what's going on with North Korea. So there's a lot of action, and I think we have to look back to just a couple weeks ago when President Obama met President Xi Jinping in Beijing, both nations condemning North Korea's nuclear weapons program, saying that neither China nor the U.S. will recognize the North as a nuclear state. So I think that's really prompted Pyongyang now to reach out to all the parties involved and try to get something moving, since it just can't rely on China like it used to.
Now, unlike London, it's getting a bit toasty in Seoul. Now, there's concerns about power plant shutdowns, and of course at a particularly toasty time of year. So what is the problem with power generation?
Right on, Tyler. Yeah, let me tell you, it's getting steamy here. The monsoon season just started this week. South Korea's nuclear energy industry has had a lot of concerns over the past years. Just in the past couple of weeks, it's shut down three reactors, mainly due to component parts not being properly certified. Now, not only is this a problem for South Korean citizens who want to crank up their air conditioners this summer, nuclear power provides about a third of the nation's entire energy output, it also is going to cast some troubles for nuclear energy exporters. South Korea already has some big deals going on with the United Arab Emirates. It's trying to sell nuclear reactors to other countries, too. But the fact that it has to keep closing down its own reactors, and there were several shutdowns last year, is really raising concerns about the safety of these power plants.
Yeah, I think the word Schadenfreude might come to the lips of some anyway, across the East Sea or across the Sea of Japan, because I think we can remember everything that happened off the back of certainly the earthquake and tsunami, and clearly Korea saw this as an advantage to, as you're just rightly saying there, peddle their nuclear power around the world. But they've also, many of the big Korean companies have seen themselves thwarted by the Japanese, Turkish deals, and deals elsewhere in the world as well. So, is this, I don't want to sort of talk about national embarrassment, but how much of it, this is a talking point amongst Korea Incorporated, because all of the major chaebol are involved with peddling these reactors?
Sure. One way or another, a lot of the big corporations have their hands in it. There has been a scale down with the change of administrations here in Seoul. Lee Myung-bak, the president who just left office at the beginning of this year, he was really pushing for nuclear exports. He really wanted to put South Korea on the map as a constructor of these massive power plants. New President Park Geun-hye, she's shied away from that. She's not talking about nuclear policy as much. Officials at some of the nuclear agencies here in Seoul that I've spoken with say they're a little disappointed with Park Geun-hye because she's not pushing the industry like Lee Myung-bak did. So the sting isn't being felt so much, but of course, these are major deals. Of course, they have the UAE deal locked up, but there was other attempts to start selling reactors down to Southeast Asia. And, with all these troubles, if South Korea can't get its own reactors properly certified and it has all these problems coming up again and again, I do think other nations might start looking toward Japan or other makers of nuclear energy plants.
Jason, let's hop into the baseball stadium and stepping up to the plate, racism in Korean baseball, apparently. What's been going on?
Right. Well, Shane Eumann, an African-American pitcher for the Lotte Giants, found himself in a bit of a controversy over the past week. Slugger Kim Tae-kyung of the Hewa Giants was speaking on a local radio broadcast.
This is your favorite teams, Dom.
Yeah, huge fans of both. I was about to say baseball diamond. I didn't realize if
Dom's wearing
his
Hanwha shirt right now.
It's okay on the radio, right? There's no webcam.
Sorry, Jason, continue.
No worries. But anyhow, this Kim Tae-kyung of the Hewa Giants said that, you know, batting up against Yumin is difficult because he can't quite distinguish the white baseball against his white teeth because it's so accentuated against his black skin. That, you know, caused a bit of an uproar, not only amongst the expat community here in South Korea, but also some more cosmopolitan-minded South Korean netizens. Yumin, though, speaking with a local blog in Busan, said that he's more or less shrugging the whole incident off. He was a little disturbed about it at first, but realizes that, you know, hey, South Korea, a very homogenous nation, just doesn't have that kind of an experience to determine what actually constitutes as racism. So not a lot of hard feelings on the pitchers by the pitcher, but of course, you know, Kim Tae-kyung, the batsman, he might be more careful what he says publicly in future interviews.
Jason Strother, our man in Seoul, we are going to have to leave it there. Stay in the air conditioning if you can find some, and we will be chatting to you very soon. I wonder, Dom, if it's the term netizens, if that's sort of widely used.
Do you know what? I haven't used it in
Korea.
Yeah, I don't know what you would translate that as. My Korean isn't quite up to it at the moment.
I do get a sense, given the wired state of that nation, that you probably get newspapers like the Chosun Ilbo, etc., talking about netizens. Should we have a song, do you think?
Go on, then. Why not? Who are we going to hear from?
Yeah, well, I don't even know if we have time for a song, but we are going to hear from Austra. This is the song. It's called Shoot the Water. Was Austra with, in case you missed it, Shoot the Water. And what a segue we have as well. I'll hand it over to you to explain to our dear listeners.
It's almost like it was planned this way because we are going to do our in-house papers and we have a Canadian to guide us through the Canadian papers at this point in the show. Chris Frey, what is your full title? Our man in
Toronto.
Yeah, I guess that's you. But you're a man in the studio in London today, I'm delighted to say. Welcome to the program. And we're going to start with, I guess, resignation pressure in Montreal.
Yeah, we're getting famous for our mayors.
Exactly.
Yeah.
After one crack smoking mayor, now it's the Montreal interim mayor, Michael Applebaum, who's being called on to resign. He was arrested on charges of corruption yesterday. And of course, he's interim mayor because the previous mayor who was elected, Gerard Tremblay, was forced to resign for his own corruption charges. So, you know, quite a legacy in Montreal.
Canadians not as squeaky clean as you thought.
I'm really shocked by this.
It's quite something, isn't it?
You guys are supposed to be, you know, ambassadors for your land, but I'm hearing some bad things.
Well, I guess we have Gregor Robertson, in Vancouver.
We do. And looking, everyone said very handsome. I think lots of people want to go and, you know, do follow-up interviews in this company anyway. He looks very good in front of his British Columbia flag. Anyway, someone who features rather prominently in our July-August issue.
I'll have a look online for him.
Anyway, and it was when we were in Vancouver week before last, I don't want to say they were feeling a bit smug in Vancouver, but they were casting their eyes eastward and thinking, God, that is one shit show on the other side of the country. Where should we go next, story-wise?
Oh, well, I guess another political story. Justin Trudeau, another Montrealer, he's being asked to repay, I think it's about $250,000 in speaking fees. He became the Liberal of the Federal Liberal Party just a few months ago. But on the side, he has been doing speaking engagements and charging fees upwards of $20,000. Unfortunately, many of them were with charities which at fundraising events did not actually make the money they hoped to. So they actually did these events at a loss. People are now calling on Justin to pay back many of these fees, something like $250,000, $270,000.
Do you think he's going to have to return the car or the summer house? Or I mean, what's going to happen?
Well, I think that's the inheritance from Pierre.
Right, probably.
So
you do realize that this is the son of former Prime Minister Pierre Elliott Trudeau.
Uh-huh.
Just a little bit of a reflection.
Thank you very much.
Yes, you missed that.
what you didn't see, dear viewer, is the baffled expression on my face, which led Tyler to clarify that for me. Is this a question of sort of moral and ethical, kind of broadly the right or wrong thing to do, or actual rule breaking here?
No, there's no rule breaking involved at all. Although I think in principle, a lot of people would prefer that when people become an MP, they put all their interest in a blind trust, of course, business interests. Charging speaking fees, I think it's if you're asked to speak to Canadians, you're expected to talk about your priorities with Canadians if you're a person in office. So whether it's universities or charities or wherever, I think it's your job to engage with the public. So that's the principle I think people are applying here. And more interestingly, I mean, on the level of politics, he's only been in his new job for a few months. The Conservative Party is famous for its attack ads. They managed to sort of do in the last couple of Liberal leaders in that fashion. And they already tried one attack ad that failed miserably, which was also about a charity. They had this attack ad, Justin Trudeau not wearing a shirt because he did some charity for liver disease, I think. And it was like, pay money to see Justin without with his shirt off. So when the Conservatives ran this ad questioning his judgment, is this the man you want as your prime minister, walking around without a shirt? It was pointed out, well, it was for charity. It was for a good cause. I think in that instance, there was no traction with the attack ad. I can see the attack ads coming with this.
I didn't see any of that. Did he look good without a shirt on?
He looked fine, yeah. Well, he was in a boxing match. He also did a charity boxing match against
right.
a Conservative senator, which nobody gave him a shot at because the Conservative senator was twice his size.
Right.
And he won handily.
Now, speaking of twice his size or even, four times his size, I just need to go back. You're heading back to Toronto very soon. Are you surprised how much attention, not just here, but that this has been a very odd brand builder for Toronto, the Rob Ford saga?
It is, well, being in Toronto all this time and occasionally being on M24 to talk about it, I mean, it's such a pressurized space and every day you're kind of tracking the news and some, unforeseen revelation. And I think right now nothing really surprises us. But we haven't been able to step back, I think, and say, how does this hurt us? Does this hurt us in terms of, how we're perceived abroad in terms of business or travel? I don't know. I think people here would be better suited asking that. I think we're just so caught up in the everyday minutia of this story.
I'm just surprised at how comatose, though, the electorate is, though. You'd think that there would be a bigger outcry,
yeah.
or you would see some voices, I think, in some of the very tall towers in and around City Hall in Toronto. And I say those tall towers, the major Canadian banks who I think did a very good job for Brand Canada, coming out of the global financial crisis with sort of reasonably flying colors, would say, okay, this has got to stop now.
You are seeing his backroom support start to disappear because he was the standard bearer, say, for the Conservative establishment in the city. And surprisingly enough, he has his base. I mean, that 25 to 30% of the electorate that are diehard Ford supporters. And you hear them saying, literally, I don't really care what he does as long as he keeps my taxes low.
Mm.
That's his personal life. It's a weird kind of space that we're in now politically.
Dr. Reynolds, any more, 10 seconds, any questions that you don't have
about Canada? 56 different questions, but you've answered a few of them for me already. I hate to be the English voice in this Canadian loving. Thank you very much, Chris Frey, for joining us this morning.
That's all the time we have for today. Thank you very much to our producers, bright and early this morning, Annabelle Bly and Barbara Feeney. our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Mr. Toby Hammond, behind the glass over there. Up next, after the news, the entrepreneurs with Sophie Grove.
And indeed, Andrew Tuck and myself will be back with Midori House at exactly the same time tomorrow.
But for me, Tyler Brulé.
And from me, Dominic Reynolds.
And also Chris Frey, just sitting across from us. It is Goodbye News is up in about 1 minute's time. Stay with us.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.